And tonight we're very, very excited that we have somebody that flew in a long, long way just to tell us about who she is, just so you guys can get to know her a little bit. I've known her for a little while, and she's one of the delegates, and I'm just going to not take up any more time and go ahead and let her take over. Melinda from Australia.
Really exciting, and it's fabulous to be here. I was really nervous, and you're just a bunch of addicts, so it's sort of fine. It's really good. I practice saying hi y'all and g'day mate, so just to prove I'm from Australia. When I got really nervous, I was talking to Dee, and she said, do an outline. So I did an outline, and it's 10 pages long. If you get bored, there's another section coming up, or if you don't relate to something, you might on the next page. So, you know, people have been giving me advice, saying, you know, speak from the heart and don't write anything down and blah, blah, blah. And I just thought, well, I've got my little outline. I'll just look at it if I start to forget what I'm talking about. So basically, I'm just going to tell my story, what happened, how I got to the fellowship, how I found more sex addiction, relapse, recovery again, and, you know, tools of recovery and living in recovery. My story is not one that goes like addiction recovery. It sort of goes as a few people's do. And that's my journey, and it's sort of interesting. I want to thank Dee too, who I met on Conference Diversity Committee maybe a year ago, for giving me this opportunity to move from fear to faith. So thank you, Dee, for being a speaker tonight, asking me to be the speaker tonight. Okay, I grew up in country Australia, in what is like the equivalent of Nashville, and I really hated it. I really just wanted to run away to the city as soon as I could. I was an only child. I was adopted, and my parents were much older, and I always felt really different from everyone. Really, really different. I feel like I need to put these mics up higher. I started having sex at 13. I just wanted to find out what it was like. It was like I was fascinated by sex from this really young age. I started climbing out of my bedroom window at night, running around with old, you know, boys old enough to have cars. I got into lots of trouble when I was really young. I went from being, you know, the smartest girl in the school to getting pregnant and getting sent away at 14. And I thought I was this incredibly worldly person who knew everything at 14. And I look at 14-year-olds now and I go, wow, you're children, you're tiny children. And I just had that feeling at that age of, just being really old and world-weary already. I got sent away. I was made to give my child up for adoption, and that was really traumatic. I went back to school and sort of had to pretend nothing was wrong, and that was really hard. And that's sort of when my drug and alcohol addiction really kicked in. I was pretty food anorexic as well, and sort of all the hallmarks of addiction were there. And sort of interestingly, at that time, I had this really nice boyfriend who really liked me. And I had my first experience of avoidance. It was like, oh, you really like me. Stay away from me. I feel suffocated. And it was like, you know, I was feeling really bad about myself. But it was like, anyone who's loving and kind, I actually just want to push away. So eventually I got away from Tamworth and I went to university, which was just sort of like party. I didn't even make it through first year. Sort of like, oh, lots of sex and lots of drugs and punk rock at that stage. It was like the late 70s and I just sort of went mad really with my sex addiction. And you know, I was a practicing addict and alcoholic as well, and I guess I experienced all that stuff that you hear about. It's like, you know, coming to consciousness with people that you've never met before, and it's like, who are you? Where am I? Where's my clothes? Where's my money? How do I get out of here? And it's sort of scary when that happens. I got married when I was 20. I met this nice boy who loved me, another nice boy who loved me. And we got married. And as soon as I got married, I stopped wanting to have sex with him. And I've noticed that, you know, my libido decreases according to how much the person I'm with likes me. It's like it's directly proportional. I'm very happy having sex with strangers. Someone who loves me, it's like completely do not want to be, well, in my addiction, do not want to be sexual with them. Okay, so I started bringing other men into our relationship and running around, having sex with other people. I sort of had no morals or standards. So, you know, sex with my best friend's boyfriend and, you know, trying to seduce my boss's husband and just, you know, crazy. I ended up leaving my husband and my house and my job because I felt like they were suffocating me. And I ended up, like, really quite young. You know, I had a alcohol and drug addiction going on the side as well, which I won't go into, but... there was a lot of humiliation and degradation that went with that, and a lot of, a lot of ugly rock bottomness. I went to my mum's to detox once and ended up in psych hospital. This was when I was 24, and I found out that my son had died. He'd been retarded and he was never adopted, and it just rocked me. I heard, you know, it was like... It was hideous. I had this really horrible six months of insanity after that. And, then in 84, there was sort of a lot of, you know, arrests and court stuff and detox and rehabs and halfway houses. And, I really liked being in long-term rehab. It was like took total responsibility away from me. Didn't have to think about anything. And... And I had this weird suggestion to not get sexually or emotionally involved with anyone for 12 months, and I thought that was completely insane. How could you not be involved with anyone for 12 months? It made no sense to me. But as a chemically clean and sober person, I was completely freaked out. I came to meetings. I came to 3 meetings a day when I got out of rehab. That's all I could do. I couldn't speak at meetings. I was so terrified. I wanted lots of attention. I heard someone say this at lunch today, wanted lots of attention, but as soon as someone looked at me, it was like, oh, don't look at me. Chatting over coffee, what's that? You know, and just like completely sexually freaked out as well. And it's like, I could not imagine having sex without drugs. It was like, how do you do that? So I decided that actually the answer was probably that I was a lesbian, and it was like, if I went out with women, it would be better. When I was a kid, I pinched my dad's porn, and it was always girl porn. And yeah, so I moved out. I was living in the squats at this stage. So I moved out of the squats into this all women house that, you know, men weren't allowed in. It was like, at the door, lesbian, separatist, feminist house, had dreadlocks and piercings, and it was like, this really scared my mum. She didn't mind I was a lesbian, but she couldn't stand the face jewellery. She was like, it was just too much for her. And, you know, and I was in NA, I was in AA. I was horrified by the God bit. I was like a, you know, dyed-in-the-wool atheist, and it was really traumatic for me to get over my atheism and accept the God bit. And, you know, I thought God was for stupid people, not people like me who'd been so smart to become institutionalized, you know, by 25. So, oh, God. So, you know, I got a sponsor, started doing the steps, and I really still objected to the God bit. And my sponsor said, and, you know, God had to be gender neutral. I couldn't stand the he. And my sponsor said, go and join a group and go to the group conscience and tell them. And that way you can get it changed. And this very smart sponsor got me involved in service. And it was like, you know, it's like, okay. That was it, and I still haven't gotten it changed, and I don't care anymore, so that's good. Okay. I went to art school, and this other amazing thing happened to me. Where I grew up in Tamworth, no one was an artist. It was, like, not a thing that anyone did in their life, and being in recovery, that, you know, new options about who I could be and what I could do happened. So I went to art school, loved it. Yeah, and things started changing in my life. Then I decided perhaps after about 3 years with this particular relationship that I wasn't a lesbian. Maybe I wanted to be bisexual. So I started going out with men again. And, because it's, you know, all my relationships problems hadn't disappeared just because I was going out with a woman. So more crazy relationships, and I, you know, if he's an unavailable sex addict, it's like, yep, that's my type. I want, you know, I want to go out with him. And a crazy, crazy things, you know, going from one side of Australia to the other with someone breaking up when I get there, coming all the way back again, all over the place. So sex addiction, you know, I was clean and sober, but sex addiction replaced chemical addiction for me. I started going out with much younger men again. I'd actually had done that before. You know, all-night dance parties, you know, the things I called relationships, which was really actually falling on someone and saying, do you want to have sex, got to be shorter and shorter and shorter. And you know, they got to be around, you know, 2 weeks. That was sort of all I could cope with. That was a relationship for me. And they were traumatic as well. You know, I was love addicted as well as sex addicted. I really desperately wanted everyone to be, you know, the one that would save me, that would, you know, protect me from the world, that would make everything okay, that would fill up that big hole. And of course, none of them did. They were always, you know, traumatic, adrenaline-filled, and tragic, really, which is a bit sad. And then I met the person who introduced me to SLA, and this was 91 or 92, I actually can't remember. So I was sitting in a meeting, and there was this instant attraction to this man across the room, and, you know, when that sort of red light goes off in your head, and it's like every bit of your body goes blah, and go, that's the one. And really, now I know that means stop, this is dangerous. But I always thought is, no, that's, it's love. We're meant to be together. So, you know, perfect, here's a sex addict. He's actually leaving for the UK in 2 weeks. I was like, 2 weeks, that's the time frame. But he knew about SLA because he was coming to the convention in the States on the way to the UK. So he told me that this organisation existed. I don't think he must have had very much recovery because, He didn't have any recovery, but he knew that slavery existed. And I don't know if there's anyone around who would remember him from 91 or 92, if anyone's been around that long. Yeah. He left, and after he left, I just started to work in the sex industry. Like, you know, what will I do next? Oh, I'll work in the sex industry. I just left art school, and it seemed very sensible to get paid to have sex. I worked for a sort of a VIP escort agency, and I thought I was very different. I thought I was a very special prostitute. I was, better class than everyone else. It was like, you know, I was horrified when I was walking along the street one day with my friend and someone went, "Oh, they're hookers." And I was like, "Oh, how can you tell?" I just, you know, didn't know that it was obvious. But a lot of it was about fantasy and not that much of it was about sex. And I really, really liked all the fantasy and creating fantasy as well. Did crazy, crazy things like expensive sex retreats where you just had sex with everyone you could for as long as you could until everyone got so sick of sex they didn't want any more. God knows why. It was supposed to be therapy and recovery and personal growth, and it wasn't. And I also, I hooked up with sort of older man during that period, and I thought, you know, he'd look after me and that would be lovely and I wouldn't have to worry. Anyway, this guy came back from the UK, and you know, I was still working, and then he was working in a gay brothel, and I was still going out with this other guy who I'd hooked up when he was away, and my life was all about sex. It was sex, more sex and more sex. And, you know, at this time I was 7 years clean in NA, and it was like, wasn't really working a program. I was a little bit crazy, and it was like, I'm not picking up a drink or a drug, but I certainly wasn't sober in any other sense. Okay. When he came back, it was sort of like the defining relationship of my life. And when he came back, it was like he became my higher power. I was totally focused on him and what he wanted. And he decided he could drink, so I decided I could drink. And I'd already left most of my friends behind. The people I'd been in recovery with for a long time. My bestest friend, who I'd lived with and shared houses with for years, was pregnant and having a baby. And I had all this trauma around children, and I couldn't bear being around her being pregnant, so I just sort of shut her out of my life. And this guy and I had an open relationship. And, you know, it was fine when I was having sex with other people. It was completely fine. But when he was having sex with other people, it drove me insane. And it was like I was just consumed by jealousy and rage and abandonment and anger and, yeah. And I really understand how people kill each other. It's, you know, crimes of passion. It's like, yeah, I really understand it. Yeah, I'm lucky, I think. I started to feel really humiliated at work. That power I started to feel in the beginning had gone away. I started to do stuff I didn't want to do. I started to see clients outside work. I started to do dangerous things. I started to have unsafe sex with clients. I was drinking. I started drinking, and I was using a bit of coke, and I was, getting quite messy again. Embarrassing things would happen. really embarrassing things that happened. I won't go into any of them, actually. It might not be appropriate. Okay, so this was 1992. I was really desperate. I didn't want to work in the sex industry anymore. I didn't feel like I could stop. I didn't want to be in this crazy relationship. And I didn't think I could get out of it. So I went to SLA. And I went to a SLA meeting and I went, "Oh, hi, I'm Melinda. I'm working in the sex industry and I want to stop." And, you know, afterwards all these men came to talk to me and I just went, "Oh, I'm not going to get any help here either." And a woman came up to me and said, "Come to the women's meeting." So I only went, there was one women's meeting, so I went to the women's meeting and it was great. I sat there and I lusted after one of the other members for 3 or 4 months. It was like, you know, not much recovery. But I had a bottom line, and my bottom line was to stop working and be in a monogamous relationship. And after 4 or 5 months of doing this, I decided I was cured, that was it. I didn't have to go to SLA anymore. That if I, you know, I'd stopped having sex with other people and I'd just stay with my unfaithful, sex-addicted, not-in-recovery boyfriend, and I'd be sad. So... relationship was also really violent, and I loved, you know, I just loved being the victim. "Oh, look, he's hit me again." And, you know, I just loved that, you know, life is so unfair. And I, you know, I can't believe this of myself. I only know this through my fourth step. At the time, I was like outrage. But, and I neglected to mention to people that, you know, I'd thrown the first punch, or that, you know, he'd ended up in the emergency room because I'd cut his head open, or, you know, that sort of stuff. Okay. So, yeah, that was pretty messy and out of control, so I ran away again. To the country. Moved to this little town down the south coast of New South Wales, about 2 hours south of Sydney. Beautiful coastal town called Werri Beach with 1,000 people. You know, fish and chip shop. And I got a new younger boyfriend, like 10 years younger. They're good, the 10 years younger one. But he really loved me as well, and so I became anorexic again. He'd do things like, you know, go, "Oh, you're so beautiful," run his fingers over my stretch marks, and I'd just go, "Ooh, touch fingers." God. Anyway. After 3 years of that, I couldn't take any more love. We broke up, and you know, I didn't know what to do. What do you do without a boyfriend in a country town of 1,000 people where everyone's watching you? So I went back to university to do a degree and meet people, and the first thing we had to do, I was doing a master's in women's studies, the first thing we had to do was look at the debate around censorship online. And so university introduced me to internet porn and chat rooms. It's like, thank you. Okay. My life became all about net sex and phone sex. Staying up late, fast typing with one hand, European time zones. There weren't that many people in Australia then, so I was acting out with Americans and Europeans. I'd stay up all night, and I became a virtual sex junkie. I just got completely addicted to the fantasy of online sex, and it's like real people didn't actually do it for me anymore. It was like I just wanted this virtual fantasy thing. And I met some really scary people online, and there were places, you know, I could see places I could go that I didn't want to go to. And, that frightened me. It actually frightened me a lot. And I moved, I moved back to Sydney. And I moved back to Sydney because I just thought this is getting crazy. This is getting really crazy. I need a little break. We're on page 6 out of 10. So I don't know how we're going for time. Where's Dee? She was going to get up and walk around. Not walking around time yet? Okay. What happened next? Where's my life? Yes. Oh, I forgot the bit about, yes, masturbating in public computer labs, thinking I was very cool. Yes, I think they've got another name for that. But I was a researcher, so it was like very okay. So I actually started to make art about online sex, and because the world is fascinated with sex, it was actually quite successful. So it sort of moved me into this other career trajectory. But, you know, I was sort of completely spiritually bankrupt at the same time and feeling really desolate and really scared. And one of these people who I'd met online, actually, when I moved to Sydney, back to Sydney, I realised he lived in the next suburb. So we started to have an affair in real life. He left his wife for me. Then at the same time, he was having an affair with my flatmate, so he left me for my flatmate. And then he left my flatmate, went back to his wife. It was sort of like, it's a nice circularity in that. Met another person. And this strange thing started to happen to me is all the people I go out with seem to have the same names. So I'd have Mark 1 and Mark 2 and Peter and Pedro. And it was like, yeah, it was very weird, very, very weird. Mark 2. I didn't have sex with him till a second date. I thought that was progress. It was sort of progress. He was an unavailable sex addict, very attractive. I moved in a few weeks later. He had a prostitute addiction and he wanted to be with me because I'd been a prostitute. It was, you know, all very weird. But he was also quite wealthy and there was this very comfortable, you know, the seduction of money, this very sort of comfortable, addictive lifestyle. But, you know, I started doing stuff I didn't want to do again, and just those, you know, 3 or 4 months from SLA 6 years earlier had really ruined my acting out. There was, you know, I'd find doing new things like the net and chat rooms, but I didn't want to go back to doing this stuff that I'd done years ago and wanted to get away from. So, we'd break up, we'd get back together and break up and we'd get back together and do that thing of like, you know, 15 phone calls in a row, like, I hate you, fuck off, hang up, and do it again. And go, why doesn't he want to be with me? What's wrong with me? Anyway. It's 1997 now. I got 12-step back into recovery by, I was house sitting in someone's apartment and I was screaming and stomping on the floor, being really crazy. And this person from downstairs came up to complain about my behaviour and they went, oh, I know you from NA, blah, blah, blah. And they suggested, and just, you know, I hadn't talked to a recovery person for a long time. And I was sort of suicidal at this stage and just all this stuff came pouring out and they just went, go to a meeting. And something went, oh, go to a meeting. Like, you know, I've forgotten that. You know, 6 years since I'd been to a meeting, I'd forgotten that. And I went to a meeting. And from my second meeting, I got sober again in AA. And I knew that if I was going to stay sober and stay alive, that I had to go to SLA as well. I knew that, you know, I couldn't do one without the other. So at that stage, SLA had been around for about 17 or 18 years in Australia, but it had died down, it really died down. But people had revitalised it with the HAL program, and I don't know if people are familiar with the HAL program here, which is a, you know, honesty, open-mindedness and willingness. It's a really quite structured and disciplined program. So there's a lot of, say, for instance, in you do 7 questions which help you set your bottom lines. You have to ring your sponsor every day. You have to ring 3 other people besides your sponsor every day. You have to write every day. You have to, like, there's this structured way you go through each step. And I'm a person who doesn't like to be told what to do. And I was incredibly desperate, and I did this, and I did it with relish because I was so desperate and I knew it was the only way I was going to recover. And yeah, and it's still the same program that I work today. Excuse me. And you know, at first my bottom lines were really broad. It was like no sex, no porn. Okay, no porn, no internet chat stuff, no masturbation, no personal ads, no contact with the ex, no probing, not even looking at his website, you know, just like nothing. I moved back down to my house on the coast because I thought I'll go back to the country, I'll be safe in the country. And it was 100 kilometres drive from the nearest meeting. And, you know, that meeting saved my life, and God was really at that meeting because it was just me and one guy, and I found him really attractive. And, you know, for maybe a year we sat in that room each week, and often we were the only 2 people there, and we never did or said anything inappropriate. And for me, that's, you know, really the power of the program, the power of God in the rooms. And, you know, he's a friend of mine today that I see occasionally. He lives in another city now. And, you know, I did a 4th and 5th step in a way that I'd never done before, like incredibly honest way, where I took responsibility for, you know, really took responsibility for the stuff I'd done, and, you know, for my resentments, my fears, my, you know, the sexual harms I'd done and the other harms I'd done. And, you know, and I found out all this stuff about myself that I didn't know. I had no idea what I was really like. I was sort of like just shell-shocked, really, when I discovered things about myself. Like, I didn't know that every time I had contact with someone, I had to make sure they really liked me. I had to seduce them in some way. Even if I was, like, paying my phone bill on the telephone, it was like that person at the call centre, I had to think I was fantastic when I got off the phone. And I put so much energy into this, and all this stuff about intriguing and creating a mystery about myself and dropping little hints and hooks, and I had no idea I did that, and it was a complete revelation. And and I discovered I'm really superficial as well, which is like, oh no, I'm really deep. And it's like, no, I'm really superficial and easily amused. And I'm going to Las Vegas in the States to be superficial and easily amused. Which I think it's looking forward to that. Okay. So I had to, you know, to get to meetings and to immerse myself in recovery, I had to move back to a big city. I had to move back to Sydney. And, you know, just to give myself time, you know, give myself friends, give myself support. I started a PhD. It's like, how did I get to do a PhD? You know, this sort of dropout person from Tamworth who, yeah, done all these bad things. And, you know, another thing I found out about myself is, you know, that I'm hypercritical. I'm a perfectionist by nature, and my sponsor encourages me to, you know, just try stuff. Every step for me is a positive step, whether, no matter what the outcome. And and I'm not perfect. I like to remember I'm not perfect. I started, you know, and I just uncovered after, you know, all this bravado of sex addiction and all this stuff I'd done, and the way I dressed and how I used to walk around, etc. You know, I discovered such a terrified person underneath all of that. It was, yeah, I didn't realize how terrified I was, how terrified of intimacy I was. Yeah, so when it started to, when I started to date or go out with people in recovery, it was a very huge thing. And my first boyfriend lived in Germany, and that suited me. It was a nice distance. that didn't end well, but, you know, it wasn't going to. My second one was about 13 years younger than me, worked for me and on a project and lived in another city. That wasn't really a great idea either. My sponsor did warn me but said she'd support me, you know, whatever happened. And, you know, it's all learning experience. The third person I went out with in recovery was the secretary of my local anorexia meeting. It was like, oh, this is very close to home. A person who's in the same program as me, I've got to see all the time, and they know my bullshit and they know my stuff. And that was really good. It was really good. It didn't last that long. It lasted about 9 months, but that was a great learning experience for me. Gee, we're up to 2000. Okay, we're getting close now. Okay. In 2000, I was in North America for about 4 months with a work thing. And you know, I think I'm superwoman most of the time. I think I can, I've spent my life thinking I can do anything I want to do just because I thought it's a good idea. I've never really known much about, you know, self-care, self-love, pacing oneself. So I was in North America, I'd done far too much. I ended up with a, you know, really sick with an autoimmune disease. And then my hep C that I got from using years ago started to really kick in. And went back to Australia and did, you know, 6 months chemotherapy and pretty, you know, pretty much just wiped me out completely. And it wiped out my libido. It stopped, I couldn't drink coffee anymore. It was another thing. It was like, oh, all these weird chemical changes happened in my body and sort of really scared me. And my sponsor left SLA, which was this huge blow. It was like, I know there's a, you know, a member retention committee, and it's a really scary thing when your sponsor leaves the program, and it's like, oh, this person I've trusted for years and years is no longer there. Yeah, so I was already a sort of older sober member in Australia, and I tried co-sponsorship and it didn't really work for me very well. And I thought I could get away with my AA sponsor, I just used my AA sponsor. And yeah, in hindsight, that was a really bad idea as well. And, you know, I did what I hear a lot of people doing, which is drift along, getting more and more anorexic, like, you know, mistaking not visibly acting out as recovery rather than anorexia. So I was thinking I was sober. So in 2004, I was in another country for work. I was in Europe, and I was flicking through the channels on my TV, and there was the porn channel, and I didn't keep flicking. I just watched it, and it was like, oh, I just watched it, and I busted, I broke a bottom line. And I think I was sort of shocked that I did. I was shocked that, you know, after all those years, that I'd just gone, oh, okay, I've forgotten how dangerous this disease is. I've forgotten where it could lead me. And, I guess I felt ashamed as well. I felt really ashamed. And sort of sad and lonely and like going, you know, what a sad, lonely disease this is. And the worst sort of thing was that I wasn't even watching a proper porn channel. It was a half-blocked porn channel. And it was, so I could hear the sound, but And I'd go home from dinner with people to watch this channel and masturbate, and it was just like, this is where I've come to. It's very sad. You know, I didn't really want to tell people that I'd lost my sobriety, you know, that I didn't realise I was so attached to, you know, oh, I'm an older sober member, I've, you know, got this many years up. And yet I was really scared. I got back to Australia and, you know, I just jumped back into recovery and, and then being a newcomer again, did a whole lot of recommitment questions and got involved in new service work, got a sponsor who'd been in the program half the time I had, and, you know, just sort of let go of my ego and just really did what I needed to do to get sober. And, you know, my life transformed. My life, you know, I don't recommend anyone go to Austria and watch bad porn, but it really, you know, it really transformed my life. I started to get far more intimate with people, you know, intimate, friendly relationships. Started to look at different bottom lines and really trying to put healthy behaviours into my life rather than just staying away from stuff. Actually trying to enhance my life. And, And in the last, you know, I had an amazing year after that, like one of the most amazing years of my recovery, which was, you know, in Sydney, beautiful, going to this beautiful ocean pool really regularly, meeting SLA friends down there, you know, sitting there, playing backgammon by the water, going for a swim, meeting people, and, you know, living my life at the same time, but just feeling like really immersed in that love and safety of fellowship. And, it's pretty amazing and I really miss it. Because, you know, the last year has been really hard for me. My mum was really ill and died, and I've moved cities. I've changed careers from being an independent creative person to running an organisation and having to deal with staff every day. And it's like, oh, my God, I've got to be with the same people every day. It's like, I don't know how most of the world deals with that. It's I've been doing it for 10 months and it's really hard. My sponsor lives 2,000 kilometres away, and there was no SLA meeting there. So it's a small city of about 1,000 people, about the same place in Australia as New Orleans is in the States. So right in the bottom between the desert and the Antarctic, so there's nothing much around it. And so I started a meeting and started sponsoring people in the HOW program, and, you know, I've seen it start to grow in 10 months, and now my sponsees have sponsees, and, you know, we sit there on Saturday night in the cold, this cold, big, dark, creepy hall, and, you know, we laugh at our pain, and it's really beautiful. It's like, wow, here we are together, and we usually go out for dinner afterwards, and it's really nice to, you know, have dinner on a Saturday night with a group of people. I'm just about to do another step 9, and I'm one of these people that loves the big dramatic steps, like 4 and 5. Oh, there's so much trauma. It's like 9. Oh, so hard, you know, approaching all those people. And so I'm still a drama queen. The drama. And what I'm learning about myself from my defects of character.
Drama queens.
Oh, thank you. We need our own meeting.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. What I'm learning about myself and my defects of character is that, you know, manageability, sustainability and consistency are the big problems in my life. It's like pacing myself and knowing my limits and doing that self-care. So that's what I'm really trying to work on at the moment. And, you know, carrying out commitments without harming myself, because I'm always, like, excited by a good idea. It's like, oh, yeah, I'll do that. That's like, oh, I want to be on 5 conference committees. But, you know, I sort of learnt that, no, actually, I can do 1. And, you know, for me, that's it. I continually revise my bottom lines at the moment because I didn't before. It was like, I had these, they sort of, yeah, just went on. And now I've got top lines, I set goals. I've got a healthy dating goal. I have to go on a date, at least one date a month, and a goal around masturbating that's like healthy masturbation with no fantasy to keep me in touch with myself as a sexual being. And and I just keep an eye on that. So, look for frequency, have dates with myself, because I don't believe as a person that I'm never, well, for me personally, that I'm never meant to be sexual again. I've been dating someone for 6 months and we haven't even held hands yet. Like, that's creepy. It's like he's guided me across the street when it's been raining with his hand on my back. And it's like, I just go, something really wrong here. But it's not. It's like, he's made it clear he has romantic intentions, happy to take it really slowly. He's a mature person. And I'm, we're middle-aged. It's like, oh, let's actually, starting to grow up. So, I don't know if I'll end up taking this relationship any further, but it's really sort of interesting to, it's really interesting to make a new friend, I've never really done this before in my life. Had sex with most of the people who were my friends. So have I got any more time? Well, I'm on page 10. Okay. The promises of recovery. Okay. Love will be a thoughtful and committed decision rather than a feeling by which we're overwhelmed. That's the promise I hear in meetings, and that's the thing which brings me back to the program. So it's that stuff about this program promises me freedom of choice from, the humiliation of desperately clinging to someone who's wandering, running away really quickly. Sort of being avoidant for someone who's touching me lovingly. Running after an unavailable sex addict or losing my days in masturbation and fantasy. What's really important to me is that a lot of things have changed. I could be a daughter to my mum when she died, and I hated this woman so much, and it was a real gift of recovery to me that I could actually be there and be present for her. And we didn't have a great relationship, but I could actually give back and make amends in the last few months. And I'm a respected member of society. I've got a high profile job. I really value my anonymity. I got my PhD, so I'm Dr. Melinda, which is really good. It's like, oh, I finish things these days. I'm not, I'm not like in the chaos of trauma and drama around a relationship that stops me doing everything else in my life. And what's really important to me is that I'm not perfect and I'm never going to be perfect. And I've just got to say again, I'm never going to be perfect. and what I actually want is to be, happy with myself. Contentment is what I seek. And, I've had a bit of a food relapse in the last 10 months since I moved away from Sydney. And it's like, okay, well, I'll just buy a size bigger clothes and be happy with myself as I am, rather than whip myself over the back or something, and and deal with that when I can get to it next, when the stresses in my life are a little less. And that's okay today. I'm on a journey, and I'm on a journey that never ends. I know now I don't get cured. I've thought I've been cured a few times, and I've been wrong. And I think I'm finally learning from my mistakes that I'm a sex and love addict, and I just get a reprieve from this on a daily basis, and that's enough. And I want to thank my higher power for getting me here. My boyfriend who told me about SLA, the person who told me about SLA is dead now. He hung himself. He's one of the casualties of this addiction. And, you know, I'm really grateful that I'm here and I'm alive and I'm not in an institution, I'm not in jail and I'm not in a psych hospital. And I'm really great, you know, I'm incredibly grateful for everyone in these rooms that shares their recovery, shares this recovery with me. You know, both my parents are dead. I don't have any brothers and sisters, and I'm an orphan, and SLA really is my family, and I really value it and new people and the love and, yeah, the acceptance that I get from all of you. And, yeah, and thank you so much for having me here.